Okay, welcome back to 2S, the Horror Quarters podcast. As always, I appreciate your time. Thank you for tuning in and liking and subscribing and commenting. We have been going back and forth between podcast episodes and interview documentaries based on the true crime stories that I cover. This particular year is the 30-year anniversary of the tragic murders of Nicole Brown and Ron Goldman. And of course, it is also the year that O.J. Simpson himself has passed away. We all know the story. O.J. was tried criminally and found not guilty, and he was held responsible for the murders in a civil lawsuit brought on by the families. This tragedy occurred on June 12th, 1994. At 875 South Bundy Drive in Los Angeles. This particular case is the case that I study the most. It is the one that I am most in tune with, I believe. I used to go down there and with my camcorder and film the locations back in the 90s. Even looking at some of the footage from back then that I shot with a camcorder and some of the photos that I took back then of the crime scene of OJ's house. If you were to tell me back then that 30 years after the murders, I would be interviewing the people that I've interviewed this year, I would tell you that you were nuts. We'll get to that a little later. Now, the algorithm on my YouTube, especially this year, a lot of it was OJ-related videos, and an interview with Judge Joe Brown on a channel called The Art of Dialogue popped up, and I listened to Judge Joe Brown to see what he had to say about the case, and yeah, I was pretty taken back at the falsities he was spewing out. You can comment on what you think of some of these statements made by Judge Brown, and here are a few of them now.
And who was it that cut their throats ear to ear and pulled the tongue out? That's called a Colombian necktie.
That is false. We've all seen the gruesome crime scene photos, and without going into any great detail of those now, that's a false statement by Judge Brown. That is not the case. Those were not the wounds on either victim. To say the tongues were pulled through the open wounds on their necks is false. It's unbelievable.
Impound lot guy has just testified that he and his buddies went through the Bronco. There wasn't a drop of blood in it. They went through it with a fine-tooth comb. It was locked in a special enclosure that had four padlocks. They didn't have the keys to them. Only the detectives did. They were instructed to tow the car down to the crime lab 11 days later, and now it's full of blood. Where did the blood come from?
That's false as well. One of the reasons why the Bronco was towed, outside of it being O.J. Simpson's vehicle, I mean, it's going to get towed. Blood was spotted in the early morning of June 13, 1994, on the driver's side door handle. And peering through the windows, detectives also saw some blood on the interior of the vehicle. This was before the tow. And if you think about it, you're going to open your driver's side door with your left hand. You're not going to open it with your right hand usually, right? Or the door's going to hit you. If O.J. Simpson had no left-hand glove on a bleeding hand, that is the hand he would open that door with. But nevertheless, blood was spotted on the outside of the vehicle, as well as some smears were visible through the window before the tow. Now, the employee from the towing service, the name of the company was Viertels. Those are the people that towed it. That employee did steal some receipts from the glove box and from the inside of the Bronco. That employee was terminated from his job. He was held accountable for doing so. But to say that there was no blood on the inside of the Bronco before the tow and all of a sudden it appeared after that is irresponsible. It's completely false. That's not the case. Again, that's another falsity.
OJ is a big dude. I knew him personally from college. And he wore a size, not XL, but 2XL. The glove was a size L, so they knew it wasn't going to fit. But guess who wore a size L? Furman.
That's false. The gloves were a size extra large. That's not even arguable.
This particular glove has a label inside of it, is that correct?
Yes.
And the label says Aris, is that correct?
Yes.
And it says cashmere line?
Yes.
And it says made in Philippines?
Yes.
And it says extra large, is that correct?
Yes.
And meanwhile, in the blood, when they took him out on the scene, since he dealt with this kind of forensics, he says there's somebody that has a size 9 shoe and somebody that wore a size 10.5 shoe that's leaving tracks.
Again, false. The bloody footprints at Bundy were from a size 12 Bruno Mali shoe. And there were bloody dog paw prints that ran through the crime scene as well. That's Nicole's dog, Cato.
Furman lives 28 miles away. He's off duty, but for some reason, he comes to the scene 5 minutes after the murder occurs.
This one here is pretty interesting, too. Mark Furman didn't receive a call until 1:05 a.m. Him and his supervisor, Ron Phillips, signed into the logbook at Bundy at 2:10 a.m. And the murders happened sometime after 10:30 p.m. the previous night. So that is over 3.5 hours after the murders. To say it was 5 minutes is ridiculous. Looking at the logbook here, you can see Mark Furman signed in at 2:10 a.m. He was the 16th person to sign in. Ron Phillips was the 15th person to sign in. So before those two got there, 14 other people at the scene were able to witness that there was one glove, a left-handed glove, found at the crime scene.
There's what they call the Rampart scandal. The four chief detectives in the OJ case went to jail for planting evidence that resulted in 128 men being released from the California penitentiary because these low-down bastards planted it. These are the same four chief detectives involved in the OJ case.
False. They were not part of the Rampart scandal. They were not part of that case. They did not go to jail for being a part of that case. This stuff is made up like a movie script. It's incredible.
Also caught on tape was one of these lab technicians bringing OJ's 10cc sample of blood back to the scene. What did you do with it? Well, I don't know. Did you bring it back to the lab? I think I lost it on the scene.
Another falsity. It was not a lab technician that brought OJ's blood vial to 360 Rockingham. It was Detective Philip Van Atter who brought the double-sealed vial of O.J. Simpson's blood directly to the criminalist, Dennis Fung, which is in fact the chain of command to do so.
But there are approximately 96,000 people in L.A. County that would match this DNA profile, which, by the way, and this is interesting, reflects someone from Northeast Mediterranean ancestry or perhaps from the island of Sicily.
False again. All of the blood at the crime scene was either O.J. Simpson's, Nicole Brown's, or Ron Goldman's. To say that some of the blood was potentially Sicilian blood, again, you're just making things up. Very irresponsible. If that were the case, that would have been argued by the defense, that there was someone else's blood there outside of O.J. Simpson's. If you think about it, there are three locations within that 2.1 mile radius, roughly, right? You had Nicole Brown's condo at 875 South Bundy. You had O.J. Simpson's Bronco, and you had O.J. Simpson's residence at 360 Rockingham. The evidence found between those three locations within 2.1 miles, roughly, all contained blood from O.J., Nicole, and Ron. The odds of that are astronomical. And I just find it curious that if any of this was true, Johnny Cochran and OJ's defense team would have used these things, especially the different blood, the Sicilian blood. That would have been probably at the forefront of the defense if that was the case. The defense didn't argue that it was not O.J. Simpson's blood. They argued that O.J. Simpson's blood was placed there, was planted there.
Guess who found the glove? Furman. Under a half foot of dead leaves, 75 feet into O.J.'s dark backyard, supposedly.
Under a half a foot of dead leaves. This is where Judge Brown says the right-handed glove was found on O.J.'s property. The crime scene photo depicts exactly where it was found, on top of dead leaves. To say it was a half a foot, you wouldn't even see the glove. Again, it blows my mind. And if you go through the comments of this interview, shout out to Art of Dialogue, you know, they did the interview. But if you go through the comments, you'll see a lot of the people are buying this. I would say if you want to know more about this case and you want to study this case, do the research on it, you know, from people that were involved directly with it, from the defense side, from the prosecution side. Not to say there's truths all the way across the board there, but at least you're getting it from people directly related to the case. And use some logic on it. Does O.J. Simpson's behavior after that, or even before the murders, does it line up with him being innocent? You know, I'm not saying you need to believe he did it or didn't do it, but at least get your information from people directly involved with it. And another thing, that whole Glenn Rogers theory, that was another one that was really hitting my algorithm this year. There is no evidence that Glenn Rogers was at Bundy. There is no evidence that he committed those murders. There's nothing to support that. And I would ask you to ask yourself, let's say Glenn Rogers' blood was at Bundy. Would you then look at that and go, well, you know what? I know it's Glenn's blood, but let's forget about that. Let's say it's O.J. Simpson that did it. Let's say it's his blood. The absurdity of that thought, right, should really hit you. You know, this was O.J. Simpson's blood in these three locations within 2.1 miles, roughly, of one another. Before he was even back from Chicago, the blood got there before he left, which means if the police were to try to frame him, they would have to withdraw his blood to do so. But he was out of the state. He was already on an airplane and going to Chicago. So again, the absurdity of that is something that you really got to think about. Like, does that make sense to you? So anyways, getting past that, let's go into this year and what our channel has kind of done as it pertains to the OJ case. Looking back at that footage that I shot back in the 90s, again, if you look at it and go, hey, Mike, you know, in 30 years, you're going to actually be conducting these interview documentaries on your own with these people directly involved with the case, I would say you're nuts. So the first person that this year that I was able to directly talk about the case with and do a documentary interview on was Jill Shively. Jill was the witness that O.J. Simpson nearly crashed into minutes after the murders at San Vicente and Bundy.
In 94, I was in the same place I'd been since 1985. I knew the area really well. My store to go to all the time was Westward Ho, which was in Brentwood, about 3 miles from me. And so that night on June 12th, I got in my car around 10:40, 10:45 at the latest, and I was heading east on San Vicente, trying to make it to Westward Ho by 11 p.m. And as I'm approaching Bundy is when I almost run into O.J. Simpson's Bronco. I would have probably have seen the Bronco sooner, but there were no headlights on his car. I swerved to the right of me to miss him. He went up onto the median. There's a middle median right there to avoid hitting me. And I realized to avoid hitting a gray Nissan also on San Vicente Day, heading west. So he had kind of both of us cornering him in.
The next person that I reached out to this year was David Laban. David was a close friend of Nicole and the Brown families. They all lived in the same neighborhood at a time in their life. And I reached out to David. He actually got back to me and allowed me into his home to do the interview documentary.
Said, Dave, I want to go find a job on my own. So I let her take my car, and she decided to go to Beverly Hills. So I gave her the Thomas guides. We didn't have Waze or anything back then. So she would use the Thomas guide. And I said, the best place is to go to Beverly Hills and look like in around Rodeo Drive if you want, because, you know, she was so beautiful and so sweet that she could, you know, she could get a job anywhere. So she came back and she told me she got a job at Jack's, which was a women's clothing store on Rodeo Drive. And Jack also owned a restaurant called The Daisy. And so she worked at the clothing store for about a week, and he goes, you know what? I think you're better suited at my restaurant, The Daisy. Well, The Daisy was a known spot on Rodeo, for a lot of movie stars would hang out there, sports celebrities like O.J. Simpson and many other players like that. And anyway, so one day she said, after she was waitressing there at The Daisy, she came home and said, I met this football player. And I said, oh, wow, what's his name? And she goes, O.J. Simpson.
You've probably seen him on a few documentaries talking about Nicole and his friendship with her. David met her way back in the day, and he showed me the spot where they met down there at the beach there. He showed me a lot of photos that we have not seen in the media. And he showed me some of the photos that we do see in the media that he took. He was a photographer. He shot the majority of OJ and Nicole's wedding as well.
They decided to get married a couple years later. And so we were invited to their wedding. It was a wonderful wedding. It was, everybody was there. I mean, everybody and anybody was at this wedding at Rockingham. And we just had a great time, a wonderful time. We just had so much fun. It was happy then. It was happy times. She seemed very happy. She really did love him, you know. She loved OJ.
You were the photographer, correct?
Yeah, I was one of the, they hired a professional, but my pictures came out much better, I think, than the pro did. But I took my own camera, so I took tons and tons of pictures of their wedding, and they seemed so happy, and she seemed, you know, she was ecstatic that she had this wonderful life.
His story is impressive too, because you really get the inside scoop of what that world was like before the tragedy, during the tragedy, and after the tragedy. So thank you, David, and thank you to your wife for allowing me into your home to do so. So Jill, being the kind person that she is, she was able to kind of help me out and give me some contact information to some people. And she gave me Detective Tom Lang's email. I reach out to Tom, and I knew for sure he wasn't going to get back to me, you know, and the next morning I open up the emails and he responds. We do some email communications, and then we talk on the phone a couple of times, and he granted me access into his home and into his perspective of the story. You talk about something being surreal. When I go knock on his door and he answers, it was a trip for me. I mean, even hearing him on the phone, I recognize that voice from, you know, all the documentaries he's been on. But to go down there with myself and my co-producer, we were able to go down there twice. And Tom and his wife were extremely gracious to us, gave us access to the interview with Tom, and to be able to sit there and ask Detective Tom Lang questions and have him answer me directly was something, again, that I'll never forget. You know, That documentary isn't complete yet. It will be by the end of this year. So please look out for that. And Tom also gave me his scoop and his experience being the lead detective, or one of the lead detectives, on the Wonderland murders. That should be coming next year. Again, another famous case or infamous case that we have direct contact with the person that was actually in charge of the investigation, or one of the people in charge of the investigation. So to be able to ask him questions about that was surreal, you know. So thank you, Tom. Thank you to your wife as well for allowing us to do so. And I appreciate everyone that has subscribed to the channel, that comments and likes. Look out for more true crime stories coming this year and into next year. I thank you for your time, and we will see you on the next one.